This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. Today we've had an interesting week, a tragic week, an unfortunate week of the incident of terrorism in Boston. We're trying to figure out right now if it's domestic or international. Things are still coming out. People are still being tracked down. A possible suspect's been found. But we're going to find out what's happening here, and we're going to talk about this on Fed Access. We have a security expert from the Heritage Foundation, James Carafano. He's out there. He's been speaking a lot on national security, international security, and homeland security issues, and we want to get him in here today to talk about what his take is. James, welcome to Fed Access.
It's great to be with you.
You know, this whole situation, I mean, we haven't really had anything in the United States in some time, you know, in terms of a terror. We've had a couple of things, New York, a couple of the places, but a real incident that took the lives since 9/11. You know, what are you thinking, James? You know, are we thinking more domestic? Are we thinking more international? Because we're international. Don't they usually come out and already say, hey, listen, this is us, Al-Qaeda, we did this? Is this more domestic we're thinking?
Well, yeah, first of all, and I've been through this a lot, Mumbai, Fort Hood, London, Madrid. Yeah. So in a sense, there is kind of a common pattern that you always look for. And the first thing you always say is you let the evidence take you to the suspect, not the other way around. Most of us watch television and they give us some suspects, and then our job is to see which suspect fits the evidence. That's not how a real investigation works, and it's not how crimes get solved. You collect the evidence and then you say, based on this evidence, what people should we be looking at? That's the way it goes. And in this investigation, it actually has gone pretty much to book. You normally get the big breaks, if you're going to get them, in the first 24 to 72 hours. So the fact that they came out after the first day and said, hey, we kind of understand the bomb and what it was and where it came from, that's typically what you expect to have. And then they begin to collate that with all the other evidence they have available from the scene, cell phones, video, eyewitness interviews, other kinds of data they have. And then very quickly, there may be some people that you want to look at. So not surprising that within the first 24 hours, they say, hey, we think we might have a suspect. Now, look, if that doesn't pan out, then you could wind up a very long investigation. Remember the bombing in Times Square in New York?
Right.
The bomb didn't go off, but they looked at it. They got a lot of good info. They actually grabbed that guy before he left the country. And contrast that with the anthrax attacks that happened after 9/11.
It took a long time.
Right. They mailed the letters to the Senate office building and to some media outlets, very similar to the incident we just had. Not only did that investigation take forever, today we still dispute who actually did it.
Right. They don't really know. And you brought up a good point about this mailing situation. The president supposedly was getting a package was, you know, to him. One of the senators is supposed to have a package to them, some ricin in it, or they're still trying to identify what it is. I mean, it almost feels like we're going back almost 10 years ago, and when the same situations were happening, anthrax, terrorism, and everything else, is this another cycle? Are we back at a new point?
Let me tell you about a simulation that I put my students through with when I taught the National Defense University. I would present them with a scenario, make them the White House Crisis Action Team, and then I would give them a bunch of facts. And then what they would sit there and they would try to take these facts and turn them into a coherent story, and they go, aha, here's what's going on.
Right.
Well, when I gave them those facts, a lot of them were intentionally unrelated, because that's what we tend to do. We tend to take what we know and try to make sense out of it, but that's not how reality presents itself. So these could be simultaneous, they could be copycats, they could be related, they could be unrelated, they could be false. Any combination
of the scenario may work. Yeah.
So you know what you learn. And I was in the Army for 25 years, and you know, you were in the Marine Corps, and you know, we know the answer is there was a great general named Matt Nettie, and he said, "You never believe The first reports that come into the command post are never half as good or half as bad as they are. So you always follow the trail of the evidence. And in these kind of situations, that's exactly what you have to do.
You know, as we're thinking about, you know, we've had a dynamic. We've built up Homeland Security, you know, 2003 and everything else. You know, we've had a Homeland Security department that's been ramped up. A lot of police forces now have their own intelligence agencies. You know, so D.C., Boston has their own intelligence departments. New York has a big one. And then people are seeing this situation happen. They're saying, well, if this can happen, they, you know, because from what they said, they swept the place a couple times. They had bomb dogs and everything else. So people are wondering, with all this stuff that we've put money into, you know, are we really safe? I mean, what's your take on it? I mean, you've spent time looking at this stuff.
This is not the America of September 10th, 2001. America is a much harder target than it was before 9/11. It is difficult, if not impossible, for a transnational terrorist group or any organized terrorist group to conduct a concerted terrorist campaign on U.S. soil. Does that mean we're invulnerable? No. But we are much better off than we were then. You saw that, for example, in the response in Boston, where everybody did exactly the right thing. This is not a surprise. Homeland Security, the FBI, they worried about these kind of attacks. Matter of fact, we had them before, 1996, Eric Rudolph, the Olympics. There's a lot of effort that's gone into planning for IED-type events. And how do you respond to that? We see the value of that. So, yeah, they're doing a good job. The reality is you can't childproof America. And if you do want to childproof America, you're going to be broke and you're going to be a slave.
Right.
And we want to be neither of those things. So we want a free society where we've done the responsible things to protect ourselves. Now, there's going to be a question is, did they do everything? Did they do all their due diligence?
Right.
Because as you know, in these large public events, we know the practical, responsible things to do. I mean, there are best practices.
And we know that they're targets.
And so we do those things. And there's a legitimate question is, well, did they think all the things that they, you know, kind of should have done? Did they look at all the intel that they should have done? And we have to wait because right now the priority is the response and the investigation. You don't want to do anything that is going to impede the investigation, the prosecution of the crime. Having said that, once you have things under control, then you go back and you do the analysis and you say, could we have done better? Are there things we miss? Are there gaps? Not to digress too much, but one of my frustrations, for example, with the attack, the 9/11 attack on Benghazi last year was, you know, we had this incident, four people died. We never got all the facts to do the assessment was, are we operating prudently where we have high risk embassies, missions, and consulates. And that was my frustration. It wasn't, you know, who said what when or who should we hold accountable here. But we never got the data to tell us, was this just four guys in the wrong place? Or are we doing the responsible things we're supposed to be doing, be able to make that assessment? I hope that doesn't happen here.
You know, is this an environment and, you know, in a too politicized environment, do we put security at risk? You know, I mean, because now we have the 24-hour news cycle where everybody's got a comment. You know, we've got, you know, a very divided, you know, Congress and everything else. I mean, is that hurting security? You know, we got sequestration.
Well, it's never good. It's never good. I mean, there is sensible security, there's feel-good security, and there's silly security. I mean, there are things that are practical and efficacious that don't make us a less free society, but actually help prevent terrorists from getting us. There are things which are just, they make you feel good, but they're a complete waste of money. And there are things that you're doing is you're actually damaging you, make you poorer, less free, and maybe even less safe in some ways. You got to break those apart. And politics is an evil force when it comes to trying to do that. Let's look at the tragedy over Newtown. I mean, are we having a rational, sensible debate, or are people using emotions and extremists to just drive the political agenda, whether it's one way or the other? That doesn't help us.
You know, it's an unfortunate situation because even with the Newtown people, they were there at Boston.
I mean,
you know, they're there, you know, trying to come, you know, get past this tragedy. Of course, we can never get past it. But, you know, when we look at targets and we look at even D.C., you know, we're here in D.C., you know, we do want to have a free society. But do you think this is a game changer? I mean, we've had situations like this before, Atlanta and everything else. But now, I mean, Atlanta's kind of was far off and now it comes back to our mind.
Well, to call this a game changer just really is wrong because it's just not. I mean, this is the kind of terrorist attack that this is the kind we worried about. I mean, if you know, and every meeting, I'm an advisor at Department of Homeland Security. I'm in the room with these guys. This is what they've always worried about, which is, you know, an IED device, which is very simple. I could take you, we could sit down on a computer and an hour, I can find for you everything you need to download to do exactly this kind of attack.
America's cookbook or anything. Right. I mean, so, a number of things. Yeah.
Right. So we can find this stuff. So this is the kind of attacks that we all worry about. So it's not a game changer. It's the thing that we're constantly trying to protect against.
You know, when we come back, we got to take a quick break. I want to talk about more of Homeland Security. I mean, you know, you, like you said, you're an advisor. Is there something that Homeland Security needs to do? I mean, as we look towards the future, is there more that we need to do in Homeland Security? Homeland Security is a kind of a conglomerate of so many different agencies and everything else. Is this process working? Are the fusion centers working correctly? Is there more we need to do? Or is this process, is this just part of the nature of the beast? And I also want to talk about the lone wolf scenario. I mean, we've got a number of situations with lone wolf attacks. Can we ever get past that point of trying to find a lone wolf terrorist when we talk about that? We're talking to security expert from Heritage Foundation, James Carafano, Dr. James Carafano, and he is security expert at the Heritage with a number of different titles, and he'll be teaching and everything else. He's taught at National Defense University. He'll be teaching at the Institute of World Politics this summer. You can catch him at the Heritage Foundation, a number of different places. He did the Wiki at War, Conflict and Social Network War. What was that about?
So we did a book. We looked at social networking, which we use for business, right? Yeah. Politics, campaigns use social networking to the nth degree. And so what I try to do is ask the question is, what is the implication of social networking, Facebook, Twitter, these kinds of things on national security? And so the book kind of explores that theme.
Probably want to talk about that before we leave out of here today. We're talking to him right now. We'll be right back after this break. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what happened in Boston, the terrorist incident at the Boston Marathon this past week. And we're talking about what's going on. What can we do? Are we as protected? You know, is there anything that we need to do as citizens, as Homeland Security, or anybody else in order to help us in terms of preventing terrorist acts in the future? We're talking to security expert from Heritage Foundation, Dr. James Carafano. And he's here in the studio with me, and we're talking about these different issues right now. James, you know, we were kind of, you know, talking about how the case was being handled. And you said, hey, listen, this is going the right way. They're running this thing down. They're looking at the evidence. They're walking it through. As we have come a long way, we've got fusion centers now. We've got all these other kind of things. And you're an advisor with Homeland Security. Do you think we've got the right mix, you know, with Homeland Security? Got ICE, who is the main investigative body. We've got still Department of Justice. We've got a number of different dynamics. Some people said that we should go to the British model, where we have an MI5 and MI6 and everything else. Do we have the right mix right now?
Well, you know, like I said, you have sensible security. You have feel-good security that doesn't actually accomplish anything, just makes people feel better. And then you have silly security, stuff that actually makes you less safe, costs more money. And 10 years after 9/11, we've got kind of a mix of that. So you bet there's good news. The FBI made countering terrorism job one since 9/11.
Right. Sure.
They've kept true to that. We have thwarted, by our count at Heritage, because we keep a database on this, at least 54 Islamist-related inspired terrorist plots aimed at attacking people in the United States since 9/11 that have been thwarted. Only three of those were by accident: the Richard Reid, the underwear bomber, and the shoe bomber. The other ones, we got out there and we stopped them. We stopped things that would have looked a lot like Boston, or even worse. So we do have that. We also have some sensible decision making. It's like during Napolitano came in, you know, one of the things, you went in the airport and they said the color code is orange, and you looked around and said, well, what the heck does
that mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a stupid right. system, right?
Sure.
And to her credit, she did away with it.
Right.
You don't hear that.
You got the National Threat Advisory System now.
Yeah. So that was great. There was a law that was actually passed. We're gonna X-ray every container that comes in the United States. It was a stupid idea.
It had an impact on commerce.
And Napolitano said, we're just not going to do that. So she's done some very sensible things. Have we done silly things? You bet. You know, a good example is you know, they released a bunch of detainees from the immigration centers for sequester. I mean, that was just pure politics, whatever. So that was just silly and stupid. And we still do some feel-good stuff. And then sometimes when we try to fix things, they get yelled at. So there was an issue about, well, now we're going to let people take knives on planes. It's a perfectly sensible decision. It wasn't rolled out well. It wasn't explained well. But it was the
communications
right
of the
So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but you know, we are safer than we were on 9/11. That is an absolute truth. We still waste a lot of money on this stuff that we maybe don't even need to spend. And there are some areas which are important and neglected, which could come back to hurt us. The most important one has actually nothing to do with Boston. It's the U.S. Coast Guard. U.S. Coast Guard's part of Department of Homeland Security. They're a vital service, not just for domestically, but they partner with the Navy. They're all over the world. They're up in the Arctic. They're doing search and rescue.
And they even started in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, they have
combat zones. We had Coast Guard guys at Normandy. Yeah. Their fleet hasn't been recapitalized since the 1960s. Their ships are falling out. And, you know, we're coming
only a couple of national security cutters. That's about it.
It's in tough shape, and it's not an issue that's not being adequately addressed. And we're not going to have the Coast Guard that we need to protect America's sovereignty, to aid our commerce, and to help fight terrorism. That's a real concern of mine.
You know, kind of going with that, in Mumbai, as we looked at, and when they did the analysis in Mumbai, the terrorists who got into Mumbai came in by ship.
Right.
You know, and so if we're talking about a situation where our ports and our coastal areas are not secure, because our Navy doesn't really do that work, so to say, that's the Coast Guard work.
You got to have a full toolkit. It's like you're building a house, you know, you got to have a hammer, you got to have a screwdriver, you got to have a saw. You need all the tools, because you never know what tool you're going to need when. But when you need the tool, it needs to work right.
Right.
So you got to have a balanced toolkit, and then you got to be reasonable. I mean, you're not going to build the Taj Mahal.
Right.
Because
we can't build a fence around America.
Look, you know, if we live in a country that's free. That virtually 300 million plus people in an area that's as large as a continent. You know, we have an infinite number of vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. If you want to spend $1 trillion on whatever, you can reduce that by whatever.
Right.
So we could have infinity minus one vulnerabilities. Right. Well, how many is that?
Right. Exactly.
So you do things that are prudent. You do things that are smart.
You we'll be broke.
You do things that respect people's freedom and privacy. And then where you really get the value is going out and getting the terrorist before they do the attack. If you look at every plot that we've thwarted, the big advantage is we were proactive. We went out, we uncovered it, we found it before they came close to doing something like Boston.
Let's think about that, what you're just saying. What about these lone wolf scenarios? I mean, what you do, a lot of times these other terrorists either had sales or they were kind of putting, you know, information out there and everything else. We've had situations in Oslo. We've had other situations where we, you know, these number of situations in Colorado, a lone wolf person who's out there doing something. Are there techniques being done right now that we can get that kind of person?
Well, you know, lone wolf's a not a very useful term for security professionals. But there are a range of lone wolves. For example, if you look at Oslo, which was a terror attack, guy took some weapons, went on an island, just started shooting people. If you look at the Major Hassan, who is the officer at Fort Hood, mm-hmm. who went and started shooting his own things. In both those cases, there was actually plenty of information available that would lead you to say, we need to do something here without violating somebody's civil liberties, without doing anything special, just doing good, basic public safety, law enforcement, counterterrorism procedures, right? So we have to distinguish that from things that might be truly unknowable. The guy in his garage who literally talks to no one.
Right.
And then, so look, that may happen, but I think it's too much to say, well, they're lone wolves, we can't do anything about them. If the system's set up right, the system's gonna catch those kind of folks as well.
Is it information overload? I mean, do we have too few people? And this even goes to the budget scenario. I mean, as we talk about budget cuts, and even state and local have suffered budget cuts as well. Do we have too few people who are working on this?
Well, it's about how you spend your money, not what you spend your money on. All right. So especially when it comes to public safety and security, you know, people say, oh, we had a cut, therefore we had a terrorist attack. Well, it kind of doesn't work that way. Spending money is no good unless it's efficacious. A lot of the money we spent on Homeland Security grants was wasted, and it wouldn't have made a difference in something
buying
like Boston.
Equipment that wasn't necessary.
That doesn't get used and you know, training for a person who then leaves and they're gone and you're right back where you started from. So we can spend a responsible amount. We can get a responsible amount of security for that. So you need to look at what you're spending your money on, not just how much money that you're spending.
Where would you, I mean, ideally, if you were Homeland Security Secretary, where would you put your money at? I mean, where would you say the resources should be divided up against?
Well, no, you know, obviously, number one is you have to be able to do your job. The Coast Guard is part of the Department of Homeland Security. It needs to be a modernized department that's fully capable. So that would be, you know, job one. You know, we need to do the border is the department's responsibility. It needs to do things on the border that make sense. That are you can't wall off the country. You don't want to impede commerce, but you want to be a sufficient deterrent to unlawful illegal entry in the United States. You have to do that. So TSA has a job. But look, we spend an enormous amount of money on TSA. And we really don't get value for money. There's a lot of ways to do what they do without sacrificing security or whatever, which is just not that, doesn't have
you
to
think
be.
It's more overkill?
Well, that's a good case of overkill, right? I mean, do we really need to hire this massive, giant public sector workforce to do that? And the answer is no, we didn't. Well, why mm-hmm. do we do that? Because it was politically expedient to sure. do at the time. So there is a lot of, I actually think, and here's what people forget. Look, it's not like we invented Homeland Security spending mm-hmm. after 9/11. Virtually every function in the Department of Homeland Security was being performed before 9/11.
They just already did it, kind of combined it. Department. Yeah, sure.
And if you actually look at it, where we dramatically increased spending, in a lot of places, it was on areas that were wasted, like Homeland Security grants, which by and large don't do anything. There's something called a fire grant. We give grants to very small fire departments. It's, we give them millions of dollars every year. We've done the analysis. You can go to heritage.org. You can look at the study that demonstrably shows that those grants have no impact on improving public safety. Why are we doing that? Well, because it's politically expedient to do. Hmm. So the 9/11 commission, which everybody reveres as a pretty good document, said we have to be careful on this Homeland Security spending, because if we're not, it's going to just turn into pork barrel legislation. And in a lot of ways it did. And the good things happened in Boston, not because we dumped Homeland Security grants right and left on the state of Massachusetts. It's because people took their job seriously. They organized, they trained, they prepared, and they got ready. So there might be some money that was well spent, but just throwing money at the problem hasn't made us a whole lot safer.
Well, you hold your thoughts right there, James. When we come back, I want to talk about the public. Has the public gotten to a point where, because we have to see something, say something and everything else. Does the public need to get reengaged again? I mean, is that part of the effort, a new communication to get us back involved, watching for these threats and everything else, and then giving the information to the right people and everything else? We don't talk about that. And more, talking to Dr. James Carafano. He is a security expert at the Heritage Foundation. He's doing a number of different things. He's got a report out. I even got this film you've got coming out. We want to talk about Veterans Nation. I think you've got a couple other things you've got going on. I want to hear about that as we close up the show, because I definitely want to have you back to talk about Veterans Nation and other things that's going on. We're talking to him right now, talking about the situation in Boston. What happened? About terrorism in the United States. About Homeland Security. What can we do in order to prevent other situations like this? We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we are having an interesting conversation about Homeland Security, about the incident that happened in Boston, the terrorism incident that happened in Boston, and about what should we be doing in order to try to prevent this in the future. Is Homeland Security doing everything they should do? Do we have the right mix between local and state resources working on terrorism issues? Does the public need to get more engaged? And we're talking about this right now. Dr. James Carafano, he's in studio with me right now. He's a security expert at Heritage Foundation. And we're talking about all these issues. James, in terms of the public, we've been out there 10 years. We've heard all the different, like you mentioned about the security codes with Homeland Security, where they had the rainbow codes and everything else. We had the See Something, Say Something campaign. Are people disconnected now? Is it just a matter of that it needs to be another incident that happens in order to, to get people re-involved? Where is the American public at on this?
Well, I don't think we ever want people to be afraid or scared, to get them to care about their communities. And like everything else, we want people to act responsibly. And largely people do. Risk communication is a very simple model. Is when you communicate a risk, it has to be credible, has to be understandable, has to be actionable. Credible, people have to believe that there's something in there I need to be concerned about. Understandable, they have to understand the message that you're giving them. And then actionable, I have to be able to do something with that warning that you give me. So when we ask the public to get engaged, we need to give it to them in a format that's just makes sense, credible, understandable, and actionable. See Something, Say Something is a great example. It's a fine program. It says, look, you see something that looks out of place, just notify a responsible person and go on with your life. That's a perfectly good program. The answer for public safety is really the answer for everything. Is we are only going to be successful as a nation if we have communities that care about communities. We just can't expect somebody to do everything for us And we shouldn't want somebody to do everything.
Do you think America's like that? Do we expect is somebody else going
to
do it?
America is at its best when it acts as a community that works to take care of itself. Boston, I think, is a great example. The way the people of Boston have responded, I think, have been remarkable. Nobody in Boston said, okay, we're all going to go back into our homes, and when the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA and the FBI show up and solve this, let us know, and then we'll go back to the mall.
Amazingly enough, we saw citizens running towards the blast.
That's very common.
You know, not just first responders, we saw citizens doing that.
People of Boston said, we're going to take care of Boston.
Right.
The federal and the state people, they came in to help and support them, but the people of Boston are taking care of Boston. Now, the FBI is going to come in and do the investigation because that's their job, but they're there helping out the people of Boston. The people of Boston are taking care of themselves. That's the way it's supposed to work. That's the way it works best. I think sometimes we get locked into this post-Katrina model, which means people are all just victims, and then everybody has to come in and tell them how to live their lives and do something for them. That's not how we make strong, resilient communities. And here's the deal. Strong, resilient communities respond best. Doesn't matter. Hurricane, terrorist attack, depression, whatever. Strong communities that care about each other and value the value of that community, they're going to do well.
Do you think that communities, as we talk about Boston and other communities who may be more of a target? We're kind of assuming that, and it doesn't mean that a small town won't be a target, but do we need to have more kind of practicing? Do the community need to be more involved and maybe have more scenarios play out so that people know what to do? Good case in point, a lot of people in Boston gave their videos automatically to FBI and everything else. Do we need to put this in the forefront of people's minds?
Well, there's a lot of social science data on this, and it's actually very clear. People are going to prepare for the kind of threats that they think are credible. So, for example, people in Florida prepare for hurricanes.
Okay.
People in California prepare for
earthquakes. Yeah.
And the longer you get away from it, something actually happening, the more their preparedness is going to decline because it's just natural.
Okay.
So you can't really... You have to put people in
you can't over-sensationalize this thing.
Right, and you have to give it to in a framework that's credible and understandable for them. But really, it's about the strength of the community. That's really the most important thing. That I feel like uncomfortable, I can go and talk to my neighbor. Or something happens, and I know my neighbor's a diabetic. I want to go check on them, make sure that they've got their insulin. That's what makes communities work. So, we have this kind of weird thing, which is the public safety officials, who are the one who are the experts in this, don't really know how to engage with communities, and the people that engage in communities who know how to bring a community together, they're not really terribly interested in public safety.
Right.
So it is kind of that merger. So there's a fascinating research that was done in New York by a woman, Dr. Roz Lasker, who they did a survey. So they said, here are the emergency management plans. Would you comply with this? And virtually everybody in the survey said, no, because the plan says, don't go to school and get your kids. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to go to school and get my kids.
Yeah, sure.
So then they did an exercise where they brought in people in the community and say, okay, you guys, and they participated in the planning. And then they found two things. One is they had a better plan because they found out that people in the community actually had a better idea
than the security experts did.
The security did.
Right.
And the other thing is they had much higher compliance because the people in the community were part of writing that plan. But here's the, we cannot have communities where, we all seen this. You're the community organizer. You're running around telling everything 24 hours and everybody else is not engaged in it all. Communities have to care about their communities and be involved in them. And they have to not depend on government. They have to not think that somebody else is coming to their rescue. They have to recognize the value of a strong family, the value of neighbors, and the value of loving and caring about one another, and the value of having trust and tolerance of each other. And those communities, when something happens, they're going to do great.
Do you think the communication tool, because you've done a lot of stuff and looked at wikis and other things like that, do you think the communication tools are out there for the public to be engaged? I know we got ready.gov. I know we have a number of different things, but do we need to have some better tools to educate the public about what you can do in these kind of situations?
Well, it depends, because the public is very large and diverse, and you have to communicate to people in ways in which they're comfortable communicating, not in which the ways that you want. So there are people that they live by Twitter. There are people that live on their Facebook. There are people that you got to call them on the phone with a robocall saying, hey, there's a hurricane coming.
Sure.
There are people that don't speak English. There are people that are hearing or sight impaired. So you have to think about these things. If you want to engage the whole community, you have to figure out multiple ways.
Do you think it's being thought about? Because sometimes I just see some solutions being put out that don't take the full population into consideration.
Well, who are the most vulnerable people in any kind of incident, whether it's a terrorist attack or a hurricane or whatever? They're people who are aged, which is increasingly including myself, small children.
You're not there yet, Jack.
And people with some kind of physical disability.
Sure.
And yet when we write disaster response plans, we write them for, you know, healthy adults.
Right, that people can get out the situation. Right. And the people who are always left there are, like you said, either communication barriers, age barriers, right. or things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. We saw that years ago. For example, they would, bring an oxygen mask and it's designed for an adult. Well,
right.
And you're sitting here with this little tiny
right.
child. You know,
right.
you have to think about
right.
these things.
Right. With all of that, as we look forward in terms of, where we're going with Homeland Security, is privacy, are we on the right page in terms of the privacy of a person versus, agencies being able to get in and actually kind of, right. where we talk about this kind of the different lone wolf scenarios, whoever the case is. Are we at the right mix? Does legislation need to change? Or what do you think we're at?
Well, people
that?
Often say, well, privacy and security and individual liberty are in tension. And the answer is, yep, because that's the system that the founding fathers designed, and they designed it for a reason, which is we think that both of these are equally important. We mm-hmm. want an economy that's free and growing and prospering. We want individuals to have freedom and have their privacy protected, and we want to all be safe in our homes. And they're all equally important, and so you can never prioritize one against the other. And if it means you can't prioritize one against the other, what does that mean? Well, it means that those have to be in constant tension, so people are
Is that the right mix?
They have to be constantly paying attention to make sure they're serving all three equally well at the same time. It's called the system of ordered liberty. It's why you can't jump up in a crowded theater and yell fire, mm-hmm. right? Because you have freedom of speech, but if your freedom of speech puts everybody else at risk, you're really abusing your freedom
right.
of speech,
sure.
right? But on the other hand, we want you to have freedom of speech. We want to create an environment where you can go yell anybody you want all day long, 24/7, 365, and you have the right to do that. So when people say, we as individual citizens have to care and make these decisions, surveillance is a good thing. Here's an example where in Boston, we probably found out because there was a lot of surveillance cameras. Some people don't want to live in a surveillance community where there's a camera in every corner. I respect that.
Right.
You have to have a discussion in your community and decide what's right and appropriate for you. That's why we created a system where somebody in Washington doesn't just tell us all how to live our lives.
Right.
That's the best guarantor of our freedom and security is when somebody doesn't get to tell the rest of us that we don't get a choice in deciding how to balance security and freedom and prosperity.
Hold right there, James. When we come back, you've got a couple projects that are going on that I want to talk about before we get you out of here today. Veterans Nation, which is a film that you produced and everything else that you got out going. I want to hear about what is your concern about the veterans and everything else that's going on out there and what other projects you have going on
sure.
at Heritage and everything else. We'll be right back after this break. We're talking to Dr. James Carafano. He is a security expert at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about what's going on in Boston, homeland security issues, about military issues, about veteran issues as well as we're starting to close out the show. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Derek T. Dortch on Fed Access. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been having a good conversation about what's going on with Homeland Security, about what's happened in Boston, about the case and how that's been leading up into trying to find a suspect that hopefully will be resolved very, very soon, about how to protect our nation, how to protect our communities and what's going on with that. But now we're going to talk about another issue, and we're going to talk about veteran issues as we close up the show today. Dr. James Carafano, he's here with me in studio. He's a veteran. Served in the Army for a number of years, but he's a security expert at the Heritage Foundation. And he just produced a film called Veterans Nation. I think the website is what, James?
It's www.servingourvets.org.
Servingourvets.org. Talk to me about the project. I mean, what started this up in your mind? And then talk about the film.
Well, a lot in this interview, we've been talking about government can't make us safe from terrorists. Government has a role, obviously, it says in the Constitution, provide for the common defense. So government has a role, but largely freedom and prosperity and security in our lives about us taking responsibility for ourselves and communities taking responsibility for themselves and families taking responsibility for themselves. And, I work at the Heritage Foundation. That's a creed that we truly believe in. When it comes to veterans, I really felt like we had to walk the walk. We have several veterans at Heritage. I work with one of my classmates from West Point, and we decided, you know, we have an obligation to do something because, you know, we care about veterans. America's our community. So we decided that to help educate communities on the needs of veterans, the opportunities for veterans, and what they can do to serve veterans. So we created this film, which is about 30 minutes long. It talks to America's veterans. We have a wide array of people that we talk to. We have some riveting combat footage from one of the most harrowing firefights in Iraq that you could possibly imagine. And a young major who talks about his experiences, which I think is some of the most riveting 5 minutes of film I've ever seen. Sure. In my entire life. And we talked to a lot of very a diverse group of people. Colonel Greg Gatson, you probably met. Yeah. Greg lost his legs. Yeah. He was a movie star and,
right,
and
I know. Movie star. Yeah, Battleship. Battleship. Yeah, exactly.
A young woman who lost her arm in Iraq, and she now runs a very successful company. Jack Jacobs, who's a Medal of Honor winner. John Miller, who's a terrific non-commissioned officer in the Air Force, who's now living in the Soldiers and Sailors Home in Washington, D.C. So we talked to them. They talk about the veterans' experience, and then we talk about what can we do. And so we really lay out the template for what makes a good program to serve veterans and helps them, and then how can people get started. And then the film, what we tell people is go to the website servingourvets.org, email us, we'll send you a copy of the film if you agree to hold a screening in your community. We'll tell you how to organize a screening, and then we'll tell you what you can do after the screening to organize yourselves in your community to either support an existing organization or create your own.
Right.
And we give you we have a basic 5-step process that walks you through and tells you how to do and gives you the resources to do that. So it's a very simple model for communities to educate themselves on how to engage and serve veterans. It's been the opportunity of a lifetime and the experience of a lifetime to get to do this. I recently wrote a piece on homeless veterans on an organization that's here in the Washington Capital region called Operation Renewed Hope. Mm-hmm. And the director emailed me the next day. She goes, a homeless veteran in New York, in Washington, D.C. saw that piece. He called us. He's in a home now.
Wow.
So that's...
Wow.
And our job, you know, our mission is to do nothing.
Sure.
Except tell Americans that there are veterans in their communities, that they can serve them. And not only will those veterans be better off, but their communities will be far, far better off as a result of them caring.
Do you think that because we are getting off the war footing, do you think the conversation about veterans is starting to leave the American public's attention?
No, I don't think so. We have 22 million living American veterans. The bulk of the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan are just now coming back into the communities. There's going to be a tsunami of veterans issues over the next 10 years, whether it's jobs, housing, education, family issues, health issues. But again, these are veterans, not victims. Mm-hmm. This is not just about, we have to help these poor people.
Well, you hit on something, because right. Some people will keep on hearing, and those who aren't veterans will say, well, you know, the veterans are getting preferences. They're, you know, they're right. Preferences in terms of the federal jobs, preferences in terms of this, you know, employment. And some people start getting tired of hearing that. I mean, what is the difference?
Yeah, it's not about that. And look, you know, we're volunteers. I volunteered, you volunteered,
yeah, sure.
You know, and, you know, we didn't expect any benefits.
Right.
We're going to serve. I wanted a paycheck, and then
right.
I was done. I was
done.
We're
thinking about benefits when
right.
you join.
So it's not about, we give back to veterans because we choose to, because we choose to serve them, because they served us. And we voluntarily, not because we have, not say go, we need to spend more money on government or, you know, we need bigger government programs. We serve them because we want to. We volunteer to serve those that serve. But here's the deal. It's not just about healing the wounds of war. It's not just about helping them transition back into the community and find a job. Veterans are America's greatest human capital asset, period.
Right.
Every generation of American veterans has made this country a far better place. Investing in them, giving them opportunities, honing their leadership skills,
creating businesses.
There's a great organization out in the Midwest called Mission Continues, where they train veterans to be leaders in nonprofit groups. There's a great group called Warriors to Wall Street that trains these guys, and they go forth and become captains of industry. We have 16 veterans that got elected to the last Congress. These are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. When you help a veteran, you are investing in this nation, and you are ensuring that this nation is going to be better and stronger and better led in the future. And all we try to do with the film in a very little way is, look, take 30 minutes out of your life. Just get the people in your community, sit down for 30 minutes and watch the film. And then after the film is done, just ask yourselves, do we want to do something? And then if you do, we have a very simple guide on the website that says this is how you do it. Hmm. Find somebody to help, start your own thing. And so it's servingourvets.org, or they can go to the Facebook page, which is just go to the Facebook and hit Veteran Nation.
Okay, Veteran Nation.
And then, you know, do something. You know, what's the worst thing that can happen, right? Right. You email us, we send you the film, you get 20 or 30 people in a room, you watch the movie, and everybody has a nice time and go home. It's a great movie. It's very entertaining.
Right.
Is that the worst thing?
But you touch on a point of the veterans, because veterans come back with a unique experience that most people never have. And in the military, whether it be the leadership or whatever you operational experience, those are things that as a young person that you get that never leaves you. And it also allows you to be a great business owner. It helps you, allows you to be a great manager, allows you to be great in a number of different ways, and not just to hype up the military experience or anything like that. But I think that's where you're going with this.
I'll give you an example. I hired my classmate from West Point, Steve Bucci. He's maybe the country's greatest expert on cybersecurity. He's a tremendous defense analyst. Do you know why I hired Steve? Because Steve knows how to inspire and lead people, and he learned that in the military. So I have a young staff of analysts, and Steve treats them like second lieutenants. He has grown them to be better analysts, better leaders, better people. Mm-hmm. And I hired him because I couldn't find some cybersecurity expert that knew how to do that.
Sure.
He could tell me everything I want to know about, SimTech
He gives you all the technical stuff, right?
But Steve knows how to work with people. And Steve knows what real leadership is. He knows what character is.
Right, right.
I mean, that's gold.
Right, right. Well, I mean, those are some of the things that, sometimes our companies don't put in a job announcement.
Right.
But those are, about character and about those leadership dynamics. But those are some of the most important traits in a company.
Yeah, and look, I mean, there's an infinite number of issues. Translating military skills into civilian skills, problem. Getting military people to learn the additional skills they need so they can fit into the workforce better. Problem. Right. Homelessness. Problem. Right. A fourth of the homeless population in this country. Family issues. Problem.
PTSD and everything else.
PTSD. A problem. Speed bumps on the road to life, my friend. Right. All these things can absolutely be not only overcome, but we can take a challenge and we can turn it into an enormous advantage. And this generation of veterans can make this the greatest country of the 21st century. I truly believe that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made this film. All we have to do is care. We don't need to be an expert in anything other than caring. If we care and we have just the smallest propensity to serve and give back, we can change this nation and make it a better place. And, Washington could go home.
Right.
I'm not saying do nothing, because obviously we still need Social Security checks in the U.S. Right. Navy, but we can do so much in our own communities. And this is the irony of this is, who benefits from that?
Everybody does.
Yeah, we do, right? Yeah,
sure.
Me caring about my community and doing something in my community, I am the one who's going to reap the benefits of that more than anyone else. People that love this country should be the most selfish people on earth.
Right. Dr. James Carafano, he is security expert at Heritage Foundation, also put out a new film that's out there called Veterans Nation. You can find it at
servingourvets.org.
Servingourvets.org. Check it out. Get the film. Have a screening. And then maybe work in getting these veterans some help that they need. Thank you so much, James, for being on
FedAccess.
Thanks for
having me.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.